Welcome to this episode of City Talks, where we'll be discussing where to build the homes that UK cities need. Economists like to reduce the UK's housing crisis to the simple laws of supply and demand. A booming city will increase the demand to live and work there. If the supply of housing cannot meet this new demand, prices will rise. Therefore, the simple solution is to build more homes. But in practice, as we well know, UK cities have found this extremely difficult, at least over the last 30 to 40 years. And two alternatives are usually put forward to addressing this. One is to build on already developed brownfield land, for example, converting warehouses to flats or rebuilding 1960s housing estates so they can accommodate more households or add in more tall towers. The other is to build outwards into the greenbelt, large areas of countryside and green space designed to constrain urban sprawl. Both of these options have their champions and their detractors. So which is more desirable? Can we do one without the other? And what's more likely to be taken forward given the political climate that we are currently in? Joining me to discuss these questions, I have John Dickey, Director of Strategy and Policy at London First, Kathleen Kelly, Assistant Director of Policy and Research at the National Housing Federation, and Mark Vlessin, Founder and CEO of Pocket Living Limited. So before we get into the detail, I gave a fairly simple analysis of the housing problem that the UK is facing. Demand is vastly outstripping supply. Can I ask the three of you to settle your perspective on the nature of the housing challenges that the country is facing? Kathleen, you go first.
Well, it's clear that we're in the midst of a housing crisis. We've been building less than half the number of homes we need for a large number of years, which creates not just a backlog, but actually means it's much harder for people to get onto the housing ladder. So we're going to see young people excluded from home ownership. Home ownership is predicted to halve from under 35s by 2020. But just as importantly, we're seeing a lot of people who struggle to find affordable rented housing. And actually for us, it's really about building the right homes at the right prices and in the right places. As the representative of housing associations at the National Housing Federation, our members, housing associations, are really keen to deliver the homes we need across the whole spectrum, from helping people in their aspirations to own to those who can't afford to find any other options for rented housing, as well as those in the middle. And I think for us, it's clear that a policy of building on brownfield first is important. We should use the land that's available, but that isn't enough on its own. And I think the development of local plans and the deadline for local authorities to develop those by 2017, a date to be specified, is actually an incredibly useful opportunity to have the conversation that we need to have about the best use of land.
Okay, very good. John, from a London First and from a London perspective, what's the housing challenge as you see it?
So London's population, about the beginning of last year, surpassed its historic peak. That's 8.6 million in the run-up to the Second World War in the 1939 census. Population went down from 1939 to the mid-80s, started to recover, and it surpassed that peak of 8.6 million. We're about 8.7 million now at the beginning of 2015. And we are simply not building enough homes to house the Londoners that live in the city. We should be building of the order of 50,000 homes a year. We're building about half that, and indeed, given the macroeconomic climate at the moment, I suspect we'll find the private sector delivering fewer homes in the next 2 or 3 or 4 years than it's been delivering the past 2 or 3 or 4 years. So the challenge is really substantial, and we need to, I think, be clear in our own minds what that challenge is, because all of the evidence is that people want to come and live and work in London. It's a great global city. It's got fantastic opportunities for people, particularly people at the starts of their careers, young people. And people will come and live here in very squalid conditions if we don't build new homes. It's not that they won't come, it's that come and they will have very, very substandard accommodation. And one of the issues we may touch on in the context of brownfield or greenbelt is density and quite how we build. And the thing which policymakers need to be clear about is we are recreating slum density in London. We're just doing it in a manner that's unconscious, and failing to grip getting really good quality development built, whether on brownfield or greenbelt, of the right kind and the right density, will result in density increasing, but in a hidden way, and new slums being created.
Yeah, very good point, very good point. Mark, set your stall up for what's the housing problem, sort of problems?
Well, you have to look back in time, and you have to ask yourself whether, if the volume house builders on the one hand and the housing associations on the other could have delivered more supply over the last 10 years, because this housing crisis that we're talking about didn't just occur in the last couple of years. This has been going on for 10 years. If they could have delivered more housing, why didn't they do so? I think there's some systemic reasons why they didn't do so. And therefore, we're happy to discuss those later, but therefore, it seems to me you need to start looking very quickly at a new way of delivering housing, a third way, for want of a better word. That needs to come from the SMEs out there, and then you very quickly get into the sort of the barriers to trade for small to medium-sized enterprises, be they contractors or the developers, to deliver specialist forms of housing. The reason why we've had this highly polarized debate about housing, typified by the Volume House Builder and the Housing Association on the other, is because we've had a very polarized housing policy framework over the last 50 years in which we've been prioritizing social rent on the one hand, for the people in need, and unbridled Victorian capitalism on the other. And the stuff in between hasn't been either provided for in policy terms, certainly not been provided for in commercial terms. So you get into a world city like London where only 1.7% of the housing stock today is intermediate. So we've got a housing crisis in London today. It is an intermediate housing crisis before it's anything else. I think civil society should maintain a minimum quantity of housing for social rent at deep discounts to market. That's not 20%, that's much deeper than that. But once it has achieved that, and today it's around 30% in London, it needs to start getting its act together on how it meets the middle market. Mm. So the crisis that we have is a middle market crisis as a result of the policy framework that we've been operating. The Greenbelt is part of that problem, but it's only a secondary one.
Okay, great. That's very good. So we kind of set the stall out, and we'll pick up on some of those issues around the density, the quality, the nature of the industry. But let's just start with every politician of all stripes claims, when they're often out of power, that they will significantly ramp up the numbers. And already, I think the sense that you are less than convinced that they can do that. And it's also an assumption that those numbers will always be built, or almost exclusively built, on brownfield. Owen Smith, I think, was talking about 300,000. Boris Johnson, when he was mayor, was talking about the desire to get to 50,000, mm-hmm. the number that you talked about, John. And yet, we never seem to do that. Why is that, Kathleen?
Well, I think there's actually quite a lot of consensus on the solutions, and particularly the solutions around land. But actually, these are thorny problems. So we absolutely know that we can use brownfield land, but often that's really difficult and costly, and it takes time. So it's important that we use it, but that's not the only piece of land. And in fact, if we did use all of the brownfield land available, we'd run out of it within 5 years. Mm-hmm. So it is an important part of the picture, but it's not the only part of the picture. Part of the problem is how we bring land forward, and there isn't any incentive for landowners to sell their land at the right price. I mean, it's easy to sit on land and wait for it to come at the right price. There are a number of things you could do. So, for example, if you had local zoning, it might make it easier, because, you know, I'm sitting here not just from a London perspective, just thinking about the different housing markets across England,
yeah.
and what you might do. And I think we just need a much more grown-up conversation about land, what it's for, how to use it. Because if we look at a Greenbelt policy that was meant to be reviewed, and it was meant to be understood as stopping urban sprawl, we've actually got to a policy where that's sacrosanct, and we don't actually talk about what does the Greenbelt look like.
Yeah.
And in the public consciousness, despite 56% of people saying that they would support new development in their area, there is often a strong feeling that Greenbelt land is equivalent to national park land.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case.
Yeah.
Often it can be low-value land. Sometimes designated Greenbelt even includes brownfield land. So we just need a more nuanced conversation about what's required in each local area. And
yeah.
I think some things like zoning would enable us to have a better conversation about what we need and how we need it. And certainly other countries do that better than we do.
Yeah, yeah. Mark, give us a sense of, you know, developing on brownfield land, you know, in an urban area and, you know, in cities. How difficult is it? I mean, is it materially more difficult to get the land and bring it to market? Is that part of the problem,
yes.
of the challenge?
Yes, and it definitely is more difficult. I mean, it should be more difficult. It's brownfield land.
Yeah.
So there are remediation issues. There are lots of environmental standards that you need to meet. There is the built environment that you're building in. Therefore, there are neighbours. There's lighting issues. There are rights of light issues. So this is always going to be much more complicated than building on the Greenbelt, which doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. It should be done. I mean, what was great about the Urban Renaissance Task Force of Richard Rogers, that it actually really brought home the fact that there was a huge amount of potential still within inner London, you know, between zones 1 and 6, that we should exploit. But you know, we are exploiting it reasonably well. There is still a treasure trove out there of public land in the hands of local authorities in particular that is not being unlocked anywhere near as quickly, and that is because we don't have a proper register of where the public land sits, who controls it. There is certainly no compunction on public authorities to release land, and I'm afraid they do put themselves into procurement knots over how they should release it. So there are some big, big issues around an efficient release system, legally and commercially, for public landowners, which don't put them into terrible scrutiny knots to get that land out. But I mean, it starts culturally. You know, countries get the housing they deserve culturally. If you ask the average school kid what the percentage of land in this country is that is owned by the state, they won't know. In Holland, they'll tell you it's 60%. Mm-hmm. Now, that's maybe because the Dutch are still making the stuff.
Yeah.
But until we start getting a much better handle collectively on that which is our national resource, you know, London is no exception, we're not going to have a better debate about this.
Yeah. John, give us a sense of the... London First increasingly talk about need to build on certain parts of the Green Belt, particularly lower quality, those that are well-connected, etc. In part, I guess, that comes from a frustration of the way that we are building on our brownfield, in a sense, either is not enough or it takes too long or it's costly and difficult. But just unpack that a little bit as to why you've got to the Green Belt answer. Is it in part because the brownfield answer is not sufficient?
So I think the challenge, Ron, as we talked about earlier, is how you get the sort of aggregate supply up in London, and it's just way short of the number we need.
Yeah.
And our view would be that there are a bunch of things you can do to improve the conditions for supply, but the scale of the need is so great that you need to fight on all fronts.
Yeah.
There isn't just one bullet that you fire and it will fix the problem. So the idea that the first priority objective should be to build on brownfield and to build well and to build densely is, I would have thought, wholly uncontroversial.
Yeah.
But as both Kathleen and Mark said, it's often actually rather difficult in practice, and there are all kinds of things that make it harder to do brownfield than to do green belt. So it makes a lot of sense to focus on getting brownfield land developed, and it certainly makes a lot of focus to look at how we get the dead hand of government in London off of underused or unutilised land and get that into development, something which successive governments and mayors have talked about and where the pace of action has been woefully slow. But I think even if you moved at real speed to get publicly owned brownfield land into development for needed housing, I don't think that's going to get you from 25,000 to 50,000.
So why then is the allure of brownfield and the aversion of greenfield or greenbelt just almost universal amongst our politicians? Why do they just automatically assume brownfield?
I tell you, I think there is, as is often the case with politicians, there is a bit of a lag between where politicians think the shibboleths are and where the electorate think they are. I was talking to someone who stood down, I shall keep the name a secret, from the London Assembly, but from outer London, who said one of the things you could always rely on getting a cheer at a public meeting was saying, well, fight to defend the Green Belt. And actually that was less so, because a lot of people living in boroughs with high Green Belt land percentages in outer London have got the same challenge of how their kids will find somewhere to live, their friends will find somewhere to live, as everyone else has. So if you live in one of the outer London boroughs, I think 14 of London's 32 boroughs have more land designated Green Belt than is built on for housing.
Right.
Okay, so 14 out of 32, that is a big number.
That is a big number.
I think if you live in those boroughs, you are starting to think to yourself, is that quite the right ratio, given it's costing £500,000 to get a one-bedroom flat?
Yeah.
I think that there is a thing about understanding. So if you think of London and GLA, you know, and you're trying to map land and public land and where it's owned, that is precisely the sort of thing that Mark was touching on that's needed. But actually nobody really knows who owns what land and where it is. But what we do know is there's 94% of land in England that doesn't have any development on it.
Right.
And we need less than half a percent to meet housing needs. So actually, I think if we get the conversation in perspective, it's really about, well, where do we need to build? What's the need there? And how do we do that with the land that's available? Because we've already had 11 local authorities have adopted new plans, and that's resulted in them thinking about their green belt and the balance. There are many things that local authorities that can do. They can do green belt swaps if they feel they need to build somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and actually I think most developers, certainly in the housing association sector, when you go and visit developments, so Barking Riverside in London, Derwentthorpe in York, they do tend to take a really concerted view about what does the local community need. They put in public realm often before the development, and that includes play areas, green spaces, Sustrans cycle trails, all of those things that I think help people to understand what can come with the housing and take a whole place-based approach.
I think it's just worth taking a step back and asking, so, well, why do we have the Green Belt in the first place? So the Abercrombie came up with the Green Belt somewhere in the late 1930s because London had grown to an extraordinary level, 8.6 million, as John was saying earlier. We've only just surpassed that number again. Just reminding ourselves, by the way, that cities can rise very, very quickly, but when they decline very, very, very slowly. Now, the job of the Greenbelt was there to act as a corset around London to stop urban sprawl. Job done. I mean, we didn't end up with Chicago. We haven't got exurbs. You know, we've got contained suburbs. Mm-hmm. So actually, within the challenge that they had back in the 1930s, 1940s, the Greenbelt actually has done a very, very good job. Land swap becomes very interesting. If you look at Copenhagen, it doesn't have a concentric circle of Greenbelt around it. It has green fingers because it works on the principle that the Greenbelt should wax and wane as a clover almost, depending on where you have your infrastructure and where you have your transport. So where you have your transport, it decreases. Where you don't have your transport, it increases. So you can get more density closer to infrastructure. It's an anomaly of the British concentric system that we've got, that you've got tube stations sitting in meadows.
Yep.
So land swaps is a very, very sensible way forward. The great problem you've got with the Greenbelt is the political system that sits underneath it. First past the post is not a system that is going to be particularly well set up to changing the Greenbelt. You know, proportional representative systems can deal with public land and infrastructure and density an awful lot easier than an overrepresented system as we have in the UK. We have far too many MPs. The margin between them maintaining their seat or losing their seat can often be a couple of thousand NIMBYs. Who get in the way of change. And so it is very, very difficult indeed to imagine politically how you could ever get to a release of the Greenbelt around London unless you start really thinking about the political system that sits underneath it.
I think, if anything, Mike, you're being too kind on the people who framed the Greenbelt policy in Britain in the sort of 30s, 50s, and indeed how well it's worked. I mean, the truth is that the original genesis was to have publicly available green space for people living in dense cities, which is done on the continent. It's the Garden City movement here.
Yeah.
Absolutely makes a lot of sense. This then gets morphed into a kind of urban sprawl corset argument, which, in a world where you consciously wanted to see London decline, which was the post-war world we were in terms of its population, you'd slum clearance new towns. It may not have been a good policy, but it was a policy that made sense in its own terms.
Yeah.
Though, of course, what in fact happened was you created an enormous green belt around London, which in a world where nobody had a car, was an effective strategy.
Yeah.
Of course, people get cars, and actually people start doing longer train journeys, and what you get is urban sprawl outside of the green belt. You just sort of you squeeze the toothpaste, and the tube expands in a place you hadn't quite anticipated.
Yeah.
We've got, I think the number is 22% of London, not the home county surrounding London, but 22% of the Greater London Authorities area is at Greenbelt.
Mm.
At a time when we have the population expanding at the rate that we do, keeping that in aspic just makes no sense. Not least because, going back to this idea of the Greenbelt as a kind of open space for inner city workers, much of the Greenbelt is of no purpose whatsoever. It's no civic purpose, it's no environmental purpose, it does nothing at all for the people of London. And one of the things we could do if we had a sophisticated approach to thinking how do we develop those parts of the Greenbelt which have no environmental purpose, we could create new parks and open areas for Londoners in the outer boroughs. And so developing the Greenbelt could actually result in better environmental and civic outcomes, as well as giving us housing, as opposed to somehow being the despolation of a great resource. One of the challenges, I think, is a lot of people who live in London, or indeed probably other cities, who don't themselves think a great deal about, you know, these aspects of public policy, associate the Greenbelt with the Yorkshire Dales or the Chilterns. They don't associate it with scrubland next to a tube station, because, of course, the metro land was built before the Greenbelt was created. Yeah. They don't associate it with low-quality land that's inaccessible and adds no value to local people.
No.
But that's what much of it is. So I think we just need a much more evidence-based, rational debate. One other thing, on Mark's point about the politics, which I think is exactly right. One of the plausible ways we might get some change, I mean, there's a lot to be said for a very radical constitutional reform, but just keeping it a little bit more narrowly.
Yeah.
One of the things which I think has got some potential for change is regionalisation and metro mayors.
Right.
So in London, we would argue that we want the mayor of London to take responsibility for getting homes built. Because if you get the million vote mandate, 8.6 million Londoners are your constituency, yeah, you can afford to deal with pockets of opposition, NIMBY-esque, that are fundamentally, they may not be irrational, but they're certainly unfair,
yeah,
in a way that it's hard for individual boroughs to do. And so getting the right tier of decision-making is important. It's, I think, not only plausible, I think the current mayor will need to go to the people of London in 4 years' time and explain how he's tackled the housing crisis, yeah, in a way you don't quite need to do if you're, I won't name any particular borough, but let's do one. If you're, you know, if you're the leader of Richmond, I think you face a different set of logical challenge. Yeah.
And actually, it's the only silver lining that I can see today as a Londoner in relation to Brexit, which is that the government is going to have to think an awful lot harder than it has over the last 25 years about regionalisation, about how you actually get the right level of money, the right level of redistribution within the country to those areas of the country that just feel that they're divorced of London and the South East. And within that regionalisation, devolution to the metro mayors, London will, of course, need to be able to get its fair share.
Mm. I mean, I think that there is a, you know, there is a sense in that, you know, I spend a lot of time in London. I live in York, so I'm very close to the Yorkshire Dales. And I think that there is one of the things that works practically in my experience, having worked in housing for a long time now, is that actually, if you get the local consultation right, that can make a big difference even within the current framework. So once people understand the need, which we're actually not great at making a case about on a local level for what's needed, and I think people realising that their children can't buy in an area near to them, and if we actually find ways of young people being able to engage in the process, because one of the vagaries of our planning system is it's quite objection-led, and actually if you're in the area, then you're more able to do that, whereas if you might have an interest in moving to that new development, often you might not be aware, and so you might not be able to put your positive voice. Yeah. So there are things we can do democratically to do that, but I think getting the consultation and that means a genuine consultation, which some people do really well, about what is needed, what the design looks like, what the public realm should be, that can be a really successful strategy in enabling the local community to feel like they're part of shaping the development, that they understand what it's for, and that they then really do buy into it.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, let's explore that for a second, because one of the common complaints or criticisms against that sort of development, taking up some of the land on, you know, the margins of our urban areas, is, well, like, if we do that, firstly, it's a slippery slope. You know, once you start, you're going to be, you know, you're building on it. I know you promise you'll only build on 0.5%, but that, you know, we don't believe you. But
a slippery slope to what? Well, decent housing for all people.
Well, I know.
And I'm a maniac.
I'm just being you know, the advocate. But the other one would be, you know, someone, people would say, you know, what'll end up in these areas? It will have, you know, 5-bed mansions for executives, not affordable housing or intermediate housing for families over.
Catherine's absolutely right. Kathleen is absolutely right that this is about good plan making and proper consultation. I mean, I had a fascinating conversation with the late Peter Hall, you know, who was our great, great planning urban, you know, thinker, a couple of years ago, in which I said, you know, the problem with the UK is it has this rambling planning system, it's not prescriptive, and it's a shapeless thing, it depends on the performance on the night.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in front of the planning committee and you're a NIMBY with an amateur dramatic degree, you will probably do an awful lot better than you should.
Yeah.
And he said, what's really interesting is if you compare the Dutch prescriptive system, you know, as a Dutchman, I understand that system quite well.
Yeah.
And you compare it to the British system, they're not at all dissimilar.
Right.
The difference is the Dutch take their plan making seriously. And we endlessly make plans and we endlessly have consultation and then we don't see it through and we don't actually engage properly. We don't actually really believe in it because we don't really know where the power in this debate lies. You know, is it national? Is it local? You know, when you're as a developer sat in front of a scheme that's not working, I can tell you, I have this every day of the week, I can't work at the best of times whether the resistance is the local NIMBY group that wants nothing, the local head of planning, the local MP, the local chair of the planning committee.
Yeah.
I can't work it out. So it is so diffused, the decision-making process. It is so without rigor and transparency and predictability that nobody ends up believing it in it anymore.
I agree with that. I just want to come back to this point about and get your perspectives on, you know, this sort of criticism that if we allow this sort of development, it won't be for in the homes won't go to the people that it won't go to our families or our children. It'll go to someone else. There'll be five bedrooms rather than two bedrooms. It'll be it'll be a million plus rather than 250,000 or whatever whatever the number is. Is that part of the consultation challenge, Kathleen?
So I think there are three things to bear in mind. The first is, if you look at British Social Attitudes, which tracks people's views on various different things, and if you look at their views on development, we have seen a change between 2010 and 2014. Yeah. So more people now, just over half, so 56%, do support new development in their area. That's doubled at that time. So the housing crisis is well understood, and I think that that's really important. People understand that. People on the ground understand that. Politicians understand that. I think it's really important to bear in mind that you've got to provide across the piece. So, you know, if you meet the affordable housing need in full, you're adding something like 8 billion to the economy. You know, you've got a lot of direct economic benefits and indirect economic benefits from building. Mm-hmm. Actually, we've seen an environment where, you know, the government's view about which type of housing it will fund will wax and wane.
Mm-hmm.
We've got housing associations who are very committed to trying to provide across the piece. But to provide more affordable homes at really low cost, including low renting or affordable home ownership, they have to provide some at higher cost to cross-subsidise.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is a simple fact, but associations do that. And, in fact, they've built a lot of social rented outside of any government programmes in the last few years. So that's really important. I think you do need a genuine conversation about what's there. Often I do feel that Mark's pointing about sometimes the people in the middle, the people who wouldn't qualify for social housing, who can't necessarily afford to buy, who might be spending, 40%, 50% of their income on rent. They're a group that are often not well provided for, although, you know, housing associations do. There are some specific companies doing that too, in terms of providing an offer. The other thing that's really important is design. Getting the design right. So if you get the design right, that makes a massive difference to people's experience of both the homes that they're living in, the wider areas in which they're situated. Those homes have got to last. They can't just be built today, they've got to last for another, 100 years, just like the homes that we've got now.
And notwithstanding, Mark's perfectly accurate analysis of some of the challenges in knowing as a developer of any kind what it is you can seek to develop, notwithstanding there being a plan, how you get an actual scheme to the point of getting planning permission.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody in the debate, or virtually anybody in the debate, would be suggesting that what we should do is return to the sort of Town and Country Planning Act world of development in the Greenbelt. So if a local authority designates part of its current Greenbelt land, which as I say, 14 boroughs have got more Greenbelt land in London than they have homes at the moment.
Yeah.
If you take a sliver of that for development, you get to say what gets developed on it.
Right.
So you can say what mix you want.
Mm.
Now, I think there's two things to be mindful of here. One is, in those circumstances, it is perfectly possible that the market, whether it's housing association, private developer, whatever, will be able to provide a mix. They are often not quite able to provide the mix that the local authority or local people might want.
Yeah.
There is a important need to recognise, certainly in the London context, I'm sure this is true of other parts of the country, maybe not all the other parts of the country, that we will not get the kind of social intermediate housing that the city needs if we simply rely on taxing land and development. The government does not, we abolished purveyance in 1660, the government does not expect suppliers of pencils to give it a discount. It does expect developers to to solve its social housing problems.
Yeah.
Well, that just doesn't stack up. So I do think we need to think, Mark talked about one of the sort of the upside of Brexit, the only upside of Brexit possibly being more focused devolution. We also need to think a little bit about how you give devolved government the tools to do the jobs it needs to do for its community. So, you know, we aren't going to get the right mix, whatever we think that is, of 50,000 homes per annum in London by type of housing if it's simply left to local government and developers reaching deals on private investment.
So just pick up on that, because that's such an interesting point. One of the fault lines in any debate about goods that sit between the public and the private is that what this country is uniquely bad at is public-private partnership. When I leave the University of Utrecht, I'm entirely agnostic whether I end up working in the public sector or in the private sector. In this country, you know, I really need to almost excuse myself in front of my friends if I'm going to work for the public sector. So therein lies culturally, again, one of the big problems that we've got, because actually the middle market crisis, by its very nature, by its very name, the intermediate housing crisis, needs to be resolved through public-private partnership. The private sector alone can't do it. The public sector can't alone do it. You can't just throw public money at it, and you certainly can't just expect private sector operators to be taxed to do it. It is about engaging together in the most complex area of provisioning. You know, what can you do? Where is the market failure?
Yeah.
And where can the public sector really help to resolve that market failure? Yeah. And there is genuine market failure in the middle market.
Yeah.
So, there are usually three grounds for intervening in the market if you come from a free market perspective. Forgive me getting all economist on everybody for a second, but it is about efficiency and making the market work more efficiently. Yeah. It is about equity, and because actually the market doesn't always provide some goods, usually below market price goods.
Yeah.
And thirdly, it's about sustainability generally. They're the three main reasons that you would intervene. All of those are pertinent to housing. I think what we've all said really is that you need... We haven't all said it in this way, we might not all characterise it in this way, but fundamentally we're all saying that you need a good understanding of objectively assessed need, and you know, a plan-led system works better if there's a plan. And that actually that's what we need. Now, on the public-private partnerships point, I think that I think you touched on it earlier, Mark, that no one sector is the solution on its own, and I think that's absolutely right. I think my opinion does differ slightly to what I think I've heard in terms of what you're referring to, what planning gain is essentially what you're talking about in terms of taxing developers. Because actually, if you think about the last recession, housing associations upped their output by 22% during that last recession. They were able to do that because of public investment.
Yeah.
And we have just last week said actually the government's $7 billion that it earmarked for housing in the last comprehensive spending review could use that much more flexibly. Mm-hmm. And you could take a much more flexible approach so that you can build what the market needs. Because we probably all say going with the grain of the market is much more effective. The EU referendum result demonstrates that there is a whole group of people outside of London particularly who feel like they're not receiving the benefit of access to housing amongst other things, and that that's a really important issue for people. So what we do know is some of that planning gain, it primes development, it enables things to keep going, it can help with marketing because people are already living there. You can actually see housing associations are one of the most effective examples of a public-private partnership. Not only have they raised $76 billion in private finance facility, but they get involved in long-term developments. And I think with local authorities and private developers, there are some brilliant examples where people have got together in joint ventures, special purpose vehicles, to make sure they can use the best public land, they can provide the best range of housing so that developers get what they need, housing associations are able to satisfy their ambition to provide.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, that can also help build wider infrastructure. You know, you can take a whole different perspective on it. And I think actually, for me, the thing that makes those developments work, and having spent 10 years in my previous job researching what it is that makes a difference, it is often the it's the vision and the local leadership are the things that you need. And if you've got those, you can make things happen.
Yes, but well, I think
my money.
I think my only point is that the default position of many, not all, in the public sector, when the private sector says we want to try and provide a public good, is deep suspicion, and that needs to change. Because there are enough people within the private sector. I mean, Pocket has now, we're the fastest growing housing company in London today. We are a private sector company. but we get public sector backing through the GLA. We provide a public good. It is absolutely constrained within a restrictive covenant, eligibility criteria. Nobody can buy these homes unless they fit the GLA bill. Now, that's something which we've created. There was no policy for it. Nobody said, wouldn't it be a great idea if we create this? No. So the private sector can be unleashed to help, but we are just not very well equipped at these public-private partnerships. And the Housing Association World has been at it for a century plus doing it. We need to encourage the private sector to come and play a role in this. If you look at London 25, 30 years ago, 70% of the housing was delivered by small to medium-sized developers and contractors. Today it's the other way around. The volume house builders, the top five, are delivering over 65% of the housing in London.
So that touches on one of the other issues. Interesting to get your thoughts. One of the issues that you undoubtedly hear in this debate is, okay, so if we increase the supply of land, if we increase the amount of land available for housing, we simply don't have an industry in its broader sense that we'll be able to respond. You know, we get standard 125,000 per year through the private sector, and we get some more through housing associations. But essentially, you know, there are some constraints that exist, and therefore the industry is not able to respond. But then, you know, Mark, you're talking about, you know, is there an argument that if we create more space, then you get more players coming into the market to provide different goods and products?
Yeah, none of this happens quickly. No. As John said, there is no silver bullet. But yeah, thanks to the GLA's funding of Pocket, we have now become one of the largest end users as a developer of modular housing in the UK.
Right. Yeah.
We've just built 125 modular homes in less than 5 weeks in Lambeth, 5 minutes walk from the House of Commons.
Right.
We could not have done that before.
Yeah. No.
We can now take that balance sheet risk, because actually it's quite difficult to do modular, because an awful lot of the banks out there don't really like it.
No.
They don't feel they control it properly. So that's a level of innovation that we can now bring to the market because we've had some pump priming from the GLA. So it does change over time.
Yeah.
I mean, we are at a very exciting point. All three people around this table would acknowledge that the quality of the debate around housing is on a different scale. Kathleen said earlier, it's now absolutely top of mind. It's on the radar. We are now having conversations with politicians who recognise that there's a middle market crisis.
Yeah.
You couldn't have had that conversation 10 years ago.
Yeah.
We're now recognising that even the words that we're using around this is not very helpful. I mean, there are people who quite rightly say, calling all of this need affordable housing is not helpful.
No.
There's social housing, which should be at deep discounts for people in need. There's open market housing, which is just the open market. And then there's everything in between. And that should be called affordable housing. That should be affordable housing. Whether it's an intermediate rent, whether it's a restrictive covenant, where it's the Prime Minister's starter home.
Yeah.
And what's great about the debate now around the middle market is that there's a recognition that within that intermediate space, different folk have different requirements. For some people, it's shared ownership.
Yeah.
That works for them financially as a family or as singles and couples. For other people, it's a discounted rent. For other people, it's a home with a restrictive covenant that can't be resold at the open market price. So the quality of the debate has improved enormously. Where we're not good enough yet is coming up with enough examples of great practice.
Yeah. John, the industry response. Just took your reflections on that. You know, in a sense, an industry dominated by, in terms of aggregate at least, you know, four or five big players, they produce what they produce.
So I think,
how do we, you know,
well,
if we create more opportunity, create more land, bring more land to the market, how do we get those numbers even slightly closer towards whether it's 50,000 in London or it's 250 or 300 at the national level?
So one of the really interesting phenomena about the London housing market over the past, let's say, 15 years, so up to the financial crash and then the post-crash period, where of course numbers recovered very quickly, is there's been very little entry to the market. So normally when you've got markets which are on fire, people pile in. But they don't pile into the London market. And why is that? And it seems to me that you can only conclude that there are barriers to entry somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And what are those barriers to entry? Well, I think you can put them very loosely into sort of two boxes, and then I would add a third on capacity. One box is the difficulty of smaller builders getting into the market, getting financed, and navigating their way through planning systems.
Yep.
And then the other is for big global businesses. You know, why do we not have American house builders coming to the UK or Australian house builders or Swedish house builders? And the answer is, it would appear that they look at the planning system and they look at land, and you just don't know if you buy a bit of land when you will be able to sell the homes you've built in it and what homes you will be able to build.
Yeah.
So whatever your cost of capital is, there's a big chunk of risk in there because you just don't know how long your cash will be tied up and what you'll be realising at the end of it. Mm. Well, there are loads of ways you can put that capital to work where you know you'll hit your hurdle rate of return. Why take the risks here?
Yeah.
So I think those are two issues. Simplifying the planning process, dealing with some of the points Mark mentioned earlier, I think is a really important way of making it easier for people to develop. The third thing, which again Mark touched on, is innovation. There's innovation around types of housing, which I think is the whole pocket model and the kinds of homes it's building is part of that. But there is critically innovation around process. One of our members, Legal in General, have recently bought a factory in Leeds that makes houses that they ship down the motorway or up the motorway, depending on where they're developing.
Yeah.
And they can build, I'm told, you know, a 10-storey block of flats in a week.
Right.
Now, just think about that. If you are doing estate renewal and what you're trying to, and you've got all of the challenges of how do you deal with people living in flats now that you want to redevelop and where do they go and live when you redevelop, the time and the difficulties.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can send them on holiday for a fortnight and when they come back, you've got new flats, you've just made this process.
Makes it slightly easier.
Yeah. Now, of course, you know, there's rightly a bit of wariness about some of these things. Will the products be good enough and so on and so on?
Yeah.
But, you know, we are in the 21st century. It is perfectly possible to build fantastically high quality modular units and assemble them. Indeed, commercial developers have been doing that and along those lines for ages.
Yeah.
So I do think we need, as we this is a sector and a mindset in a country that's just very conservative about house building.
Kathleen?
I mean, I think we're in danger of assuming that developers are the only people who develop, and, you know, clearly housing associations built 40% of the homes as that total completed 40,000 in the last full financial year. I think that there are, we do need more land to come forward more quickly, that is true. I think one of the unique selling points of housing associations is that it is a not-for-profit model, so everything is reinvested back into new supply, and that is why they do effectively put their money where their mouth is and want to deliver a range of price points.
I mean, it's a, as an organisation, we have lots of housing associations who are members, and I, you know, I have to say, I think of housing associations as, at least in part, not-for-profit developers, because that's increasingly what the business model is.
Yeah.
So I think what you can do, of course, is you can untie the hands of local government, as Mark suggested, so that when they do their what's the best value for my land that I'm selling consideration, they're enabled to, they're freed up to take account of future value and other arrangements rather than just having to get the best price. I think that there are real opportunities around zoning, because that gives everybody certainty about what's expected to be building, and you could then expect a more functional land market, because actually our land market is dysfunctional. On innovation and modern methods of construction, we have a very clear understanding about why that's never taken off. Some of it is about, it's not necessarily cheaper, but it is quicker. The incentives in our system are not necessarily to do it more quickly, but actually that could change. I think if you had a government now that took the view that that $7 billion could be invested more flexibly across different tenures, then what you know, you've got a certainty of demand, you've got a certainty of investment, and the people who are investing then in factories on modern methods of construction, which actually a lot of sectors are looking at, then have the order book that they need to actually make a difference. Because one of the main things that's hampered using modern methods of construction is actually that there has not been a consistent enough demand in terms of their role in the supply chain. Actually, that could change. So, you know, they do offer potential. They can offer very, you know, attractive ways of delivering homes. And they can also be really useful, you know, in terms of kind of temporary planning permission and different things that you can do to meet housing need in a city like London.
And given if some of those flexibilities that you were talking about, Kathleen, were sort of introduced and offered, do you have a sense as to, you know, the order of magnitude in terms of increased capacity or increased output that you might see through the, and that's a tough question, but, you know, could you see or have some sense as to how much more could be produced from the, you know, from the housing association industry?
I mean, I think with the right flexibilities, what our members are saying is that, you know, they're keen to keep building, they want to up their ambition in that. And that means that you've got to take account of the local market and you've got to take account of need there. So what we are facing is a situation where post the referendum, You know, we know that we already import something like 5 billion worth of construction materials to do buildings, so clearly there is a risk of imported inflation there. There are a number of challenges. But what we do know, if you look at past learning, is if the government acts quickly and acts now, then you can keep supply moving and you can keep it going.
But I agree with that, but in a sense, you know, if we're looking for reasons to build, I know you talk about need, but if you flip that round and just look at market prices and price, you know, prices as signals, there's no doubt that, you know, in a great number of places, house prices now are, you know, in the order of 15, 16 times the wage. Never mind the, you know, the need element.
But are
we should be building. No, but there's a general sense as to, you know, whether we need to fully understand the need or just simply respond better to market signals.
Can we go just go back in time again? Yeah. Because I think it's always helpful to have a historical perspective about this. I mean, Kathleen is quite right. The Housing Association are doing a glowing job. They haven't had an easy government with which to work. And one would hope that the new government is going to try and understand that in a capacity-constrained marketplace, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense to, you know, reduce the rents of the housing association world at a point at which they are one of the channels to market for extra supply. So, you know, quite right to make all of those points. The fact of the matter is that there has only been one point within the history of this country since the Second World War that we've been building consistently more housing, and that's when the public sector has been putting a lot of money into it.
Yeah.
You know, Homes for Heroes, Macmillan, who was the greatest housing minister this country's ever seen. And we haven't got that level of public investment in housing. So one of the things post-Brexit, hopefully, that could come out is that if we're going to have fiscal inducements on the kind of scale that the country will need to be economically active, then I think we need to see a government programme, a big government programme that invests not just in housing associations, not just in local authorities, not just in the private sector, but maybe the government needs to set up its own housing company as well. This is very serious.
I agree with that, Mark, but if you simply increase the supply of money to build more housing and you don't also open up, increase the land supply, essentially you're going to just increase competition. A sensible program
will bring all of these things together. I just want to go back to John's earlier point, because it is an extraordinary conundrum, isn't it? Why, when house prices keep rising and everybody's talking about this undersupply of housing, why is it that London and the South East in the last 10 years haven't been able to see more entrants come into the market? And the simple answer to John's question is that the planning system only favours two kinds of developer: the absurdly large and the absurdly small.
Right.
The absurdly large can take in the inherent inefficiency of our planning system,
yeah,
absorb it within a pipeline of land and activity, and just take it on the chin. And the absurdly small doesn't do 5 local authorities, 10 local authorities, just as one or two.
Yeah.
These are people who've got, you know, 5 people in a van, and when it gets stuff in their local authority, they close business for 18 months, 2 years.
Yeah.
The biggest housing companies in our country are much bigger than in France and Germany, and the smallest are much smaller, and we don't have, a middle market. We don't have regional developers.
Mm.
London, over the last 20 years, has lost all its regional developers.
Being as two-thirds of your panellists are from London, I think one of the important things to say about your question about prices and price signals is actually rent is important and is just as much of a signal.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And then I think and that's particularly why you would ask for flexibility at a time like now and ask for the government to consider the broad nature of where its investment is going around low-cost home ownership, intermediate and social and affordable renting. Mm. All of these products are important, particularly in a place like London, which actually has the largest private rented sector and the lowest rate of ownership. I think we have to remember that, because one of the interesting things about the Housing Association model, of course, is that your rental revenue is also onward funding your development. So actually, that is why I think the broad nature of an offer is important. Price signals are important, as are the level of transactions, indeed, and they are exactly the signals that developers will look for.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, a price drop tends to be a signal to stop building, whereas actually housing associations' model would be to keep building, and they might change the profile of what they build. That, I think, is really important, and that's why I think it just demonstrates the symbiotic relationship of different developers, housing associations, local authorities and providers on the ground, whether they're public or private sector, everybody has a role to play.
Great. So as we begin to try and draw it together, we've talked about different aspects. We talked about, you know, consultation and the consultation process being incredibly important, planning system and, you know, making that slightly less difficult to navigate. We talked about land supply and the quality of the product and the process just for, you know, in its own right, but actually as a means then to gain more acceptance of new development. What would we like to see, or what would you want to see happen in terms of progressing, you know, the housing agenda? You know, I think it's an interesting observation. I don't know if you agree, John, but in the devolution context, actually, there has been very little conversation really about housing. You know, I think it's waxed and waned in terms of its significance in, particularly out of London. You talk to Manchester and talk, you know, they talk about other things, transport, infrastructure. Yeah. Actually, housing has been, and I just wonder whether we, you know, we need to, what's the policy response and from whom do we, you know, do we require to get some traction on this?
So one of the interesting things about the mayoral election this year, 2016, the May election, is that the three issues that dominated the campaign were housing. Mm-hmm. That was not true in 2012 or 2008 but it was true this time. And there is no doubt this is the central political issue at a London level in the city today. Now, there are a range of things that can be done. There is, if you keep saying there's silver bullet, but there's a range of things that can be done. I think there's a package of things that London government can do to make the system easier and more transparent, which will encourage entry and will encourage a range of developers.
Yeah.
I think there's a range of things that London government can champion. As Kathleen said, there are developers doing some interesting stuff around innovative mechanisms. There are builders like Mark's doing interesting kinds of development. I think we need to be encouraging of innovation because by and large, innovators find it difficult to navigate planning authorities at a borough level who just aren't good with new. So there's a bunch of stuff that can be done there.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, we should also be a bit of innovation around type. So one of the big potential areas for growth in London over the next few years, I suspect the same is true in other cities given the macroeconomic climate, is build-to-rent, institutional PRS and investment in new rental stock at scale. I think there's a set of issues that we need to grip around land. There is a London Land Commission, a London Land Register.
Mm-hmm.
We need to move from the analysis phase of kind of knowing that it's public land into vigorously getting that land into development.
Yeah.
And then finally, there is, as there always is, money. We will not get the right volume and the right mix without more public investment in housing.
Mm.
Ideally, that would be done in a smart, counter-cyclical, innovative, sophisticated, enabling, I can continue with adjectives
yes.
way,
yeah.
but fundamentally it boils down to billions of investments in the city's housing stock.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of package of things we need. And we think that requires the London government to pull all the levers it's got. And as those gears begin to mesh, it needs to be able to go to central government and say, we're doing what we can. We cannot do more without more powers and more resources.
Yeah, very good. Mark?
So I think it's about getting the devolution that London deserves. I'm very pleased to see Sadiq Khan instigating or reinstigating the Travers Commission on the fiscal picture and the relationship between London and the centre. I think it's very, very important. I think that you're not a player in the housing market at any level, whether you're a housing association, a developer or a government institution, unless you've got land. Hamburg is the one politicians keep flying out to. I can name various other cities in continental Europe where they go and say, oh my God, isn't it amazing what these people have done? And if only we could do this, we need more of this and more of that. The truth of the matter is Hamburg had its own fiscal base. It has a very large tax base from which it was buying its own land. And it was buying land around the harbour and it was giving itself planning permission. And it was then selling the land at enhanced values. Now, until we get a GLA capable of playing at that level, it's not going to be able to do a very important, and that's my last point, a very important extra thing that needs doing in London is the Mayor of London has to become a broker of deals between the 33 authorities. Because otherwise, it's going to be the Balkans out there.
Yeah.
You cannot have 33 plan-led systems within London. The mayor has to become more of a player so that we can have to discuss about where should this kind of housing best sit in London.
Let me just add to that. I mean, to state the obvious, if you've got 33 housing authorities in London with 33 different approaches to affordable versus social versus density versus mix, what are the chances you're going to deliver the right mix for London? It's not high, is it?
No.
I think there's something really important to note in that, London is an atypical place in all sorts of ways, and it's very important as a world city, but you do have the whole other rest of the country to consider. And I think that it's not necessarily your tax base that enables you to be more effective at land or housing, actually. And I think that's really important to bear in mind because what it just demonstrates, which is the main point to make about housing, is having a strategic picture is crucially important because you need all the bits working together. So I would definitely say that you need continued government investment.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, everybody would always welcome more investment, but you can be much more flexible with what you've got. And that could be outcomes focused. It could be more flexible in terms of what it would support. I think you can be more effective at bringing land and planning forward. I'm not sure I would agree entirely about your analysis of devolution and housing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say that they haven't always had housing central enough and clear enough focus
yeah.
in some of the deals
yeah.
that have been done. But, you know, we've recently seen the East Anglia deal, which actually did have a specific
yeah.
housing ring
yeah.
fence fund and did specifically include social housing.
Yeah.
So what I would say is there are lots of conversations and lots of work going on the ground, including Manchester and other cities,
yeah.
specifically about housing and what's the right housing offer.
I suppose the question to you would be, you know, in a sense, would you welcome more empowered, you know, city regions, whether it's Manchester or Sheffield or, you know, these other places, more empowered to be able to construct and craft a housing policy, which picks up many of the issues that John and Mark have raised, and obviously you've raised as well, to be able to do that themselves rather than having to essentially try to shoehorn national government policy into their particular place?
So I appreciate that you work for the Centre for Cities.
No.
And actually, I think one of the interesting... Just the bare fact we should note is that not everywhere is a city.
Indeed not.
And so actually this is why you do need a strategic framework. That being said, I do think devolution offers a lot of opportunities for cities. It offers opportunities for cooperation, which enable you to take a broader view. That is indeed valuable. But what you don't want is a twin track system where cities can get extra deals and actually other areas, you know, be they market towns or rural areas, don't have any of the same opportunities. And that's why I think we need that to be within a strategic framework. A strategic plan for housing that just takes into account all of those different places, because every place has its function.
Fantastic. My guests today have been John Dickey, Kathleen Kelly and Mark Blessing. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.